Hello, welcome to another edition of the Raw Rugby Podcast. Christy Doran with you, Matt Tamua on the other side of this line. Matt, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, mate. We had another Aussie win against a Kiwi side in New Zealand, no doubt. So always positive when that happens because it hasn't happened much in the last few years, as we know.
Chalk it up. So we've gone the Tars followed by the Reds, the Brumbies.
One in a row. Yeah.
We'll count
it. It's a weekly occurrence, I know.
It is, though, to be serious for a moment, it's encouraging signs from Aussie rugby. Is the gap closing, or is there a couple of reasons why it might seem at the moment that Australian rugby's picked up a fair bit?
I think teams like the Reds and Brumbies, we're doing quite well there. And then I think you're also seeing a post-World Cup exodus of Kiwi players, unfortunately. We haven't experienced that as much because we have the Lions coming up, so a lot of our boys are hanging around. You know, that being said, winning's better than losing, so we'll take it.
All right, we're going to cover a fair bit of Super Rugby, but we're also going to have Mick Burns join the pod, and he's a bloke that's given a lot to the game and been across multiple of them as well. So looking forward to coming out and talking to Mick. And we'll look ahead. It's a big one. Of course, the Waratahs desperately needing a win. The Rebels still in a bit of drama financially. There's some big meetings happening with Rugby Australia soon. So a lot to talk about. Hey, Matt, tell me, mate, what caught your eye off the back of round four Super Rugby?
Yeah, look, good round, I thought, to watch, but in particular would have been, the first or second game of the Reds versus Rebels. Down in Melbourne, we mentioned last week that potentially the Reds could have a little bit of a hangover effect, but I don't know about you, they looked good. They looked sharp and energetic.
They were so quick out of the blocks, and you're right, that is a big thing for the Reds. It had a banana kind of peel game written all over it off the back of a huge win against the Chiefs, but Les Kiss's coaching environment, the experience, that's the sort of thing that leads to consistency, a level head, someone that's been there and done that. I think it's the back row of the Reds that I'm just loving at the moment, and Harry Wilson, the consistency that he's providing, the little subtleties in his game. Fraser McWright has been the player of the tournament so far, and that game on the weekend reinforced that. So good at the breakdown, so good in the open, but also just the ability to adapt from the Reds was an Isaac Henry devastating injury. Josh Luke slips into inside centre and shows that poise, but also gets in the ball and a breakdown steal. Things are going really, really well for the Reds. I know that there's a player that's standing out for you in your eyes as well.
Yeah, the back row have been great. And, yeah, for me, Seruiru has been unbelievable. I thought it probably a year or two ago, this guy could, you know, easily wear a gold jersey. And then I just thought on the weekend he saw a very complete performance from him. He has, I might have tweeted this on the weekend, he reminds me a lot of Scott Fardy. And not just because of the headgear, but just he's really good at his breakdown work. His defense, he's very good. But then he pops up in offload positions. He reads the game very well. So Fardy was, you know, he wasn't the most athletic guy, but he would pop up in positions because he could just read the game. And I think Seruiru's got that about him. And I'm super excited. I think he's got a gold jersey this year in my mind.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how he fits under a Joe Schmidt kind of coached environment, but I know Laurie Fisher's a big fan. He was with Australia A last year, the Barbarians. He's played at, I think, number 7 at times. So that shows the versatility. I don't know if he's necessarily a test second rower, but blimey, he'd be a very useful player off the bench. Can cover so many positions and just brings something a little bit different to a lot of other Aussie rugby forwards, I think.
He does, and he's tall, so he's a jumping back rower in my mind. He reminds me very, like, as I said, Scott Fardy, another guy, Lockie McCaffrey, guys who just read the play very, very well. So, look, I don't think it would be he's not your abrasive second rower who's going to set the tone like a Bucky's Botha or the like, but I think he adds an extra element to the game, whether it be from six or whether it be later in the match when it starts to open up.
I might be stealing your idea, but The other thing that was so apparent on the weekend, and having covered the Waratahs Blues game, and I went down on ground level at one point in time because I feel like the Waratahs media, or the media box up at Allianz Stadium is just so far away, you don't get a proper feel of it. But the goal kicking, what is going on with goal kickers across the board, Matt? Because it was an ugly weekend for pretty much every kicker, including Australia's Ben Donaldson.
It was. I'm a kicker. I've missed from in front many times, and no doubt I will continue to do so. But on the weekend, it was unusually so. And you compare that to watching the Six Nations, or you compare that to the Premiership, it just doesn't happen as much. And like we saw some absolute howlers from the Crusaders games, but there were a lot from in front, 30 out in front, and you know a lot of I don't know what it is. I think maybe in the Southern Hemisphere, particularly Australia and New Zealand, we don't see it as a primary role for your fly half. Like you've very much got to be run, pass, kick, and then, he hits a few goals as well. And I don't know if it's a rugby league influence, but personally, I think you need a 10 who kicks his goals, and that's very important in test level. I found it very odd. I know we mentioned it earlier. But there was a lot, and I don't know if it's the ball. It might be the ball. Mick Burns coming on later, and I'm sure he'll blame it on the ball. But it was very unusual.
It's fascinating when you put it in a national lens, because over the years, I know Bernard Foley had an amazing 2015 World Cup campaign where he was clutch, and he's proved that quite a few times. But there's not been many goal kickers in Aussie rugby really since maybe Elton Flatley 03 World Cup, Matt Burke 99 World Cup. There's not been too many clutch goal kickers. James O'Connor in the 2011 World Cup came up with a couple of really impressive ones against the Box in the quarterfinal. But it's been an issue that's plagued Australian rugby for a while. Would you consider paying... So Noah Lolasiyo is probably the exception of it, a guy that's kicking goals... won matches for the Wallabies off the back of his goal kicking. How would that change for you if you're a selector or a Joe Schmidt thinking about the Wallabies at the moment, needing to win tests if it's the Lions in a year's time? Carter Gordon's struggled with his goal kicking, continually misses on the right-hand side. He's missed a couple of simple ones just right of the post. Ben Donaldson had a shocker on the weekend, a couple of penalties. Would it influence your 9-10 selection? I know that Dono can play at fullback, and he did that in the World Cup, but Ryan Lonergan can goal kick, but there's not too many others from the inside backs that can kick. So how might that change your selection for the Wallabies?
Yeah, I think it has to be taken into account. I think we very much prioritise ball play. I don't know if it's our rugby league influence, you know, that, you know, kicking's only worth 2 points or, you know, penalty or whatever. Like, it's not worth as much in rugby league, and hence we prioritise running and finding space. And I think that's great. But, you know, particularly at the test level, you've got to kick your goals. I remember when I used to play at the Rebels, we used to work off a pyramid on what wins games, and it was developed by Rassie Erasmus, and you talk about like set piece, blah blah blah. But one of the biggest ones was goal kicking at 80%. That was just like, and that was a marker that we had to do. So, yeah, I would pick someone who kicks at 80 versus someone who kicks at 70. But you know, he might be a little bit less physical or whatever else, but. Like, and in this case, it's Noah. Noah's kicking very well. We saw on the weekend, he just didn't miss, and it took pressure off the team. You know, I think that's a huge feather in his cap when you're on the selection table against someone else like Donaldson.
Yeah, another player that's come back and made his way back over the weekend, but has had a terrible run of injuries. Will Harrison in 2020 and 2021, when he came back, was striking at, I think, about 90%. In that 21 season, which was just phenomenal. So great to see Will Harrison back. Another guy that made his return is Curtly Beale for Randwick. I know that you've played a lot with him at World Cups. The question for you is, would you consider a Curtly Beale as a 35-year-old? Does he have more to give Australian rugby, or do you feel like Australian rugby has to perhaps move on from Curtly?
Oh, I think Curtly can offer a lot. Curtly's been, you know, in the environment for so long. He's been overseas. He's managed many ups and downs in his careers, and to think that he doesn't have some wisdom in that, you know, in his brain, in his head, sorry, would be silly. Like he can 100% offer a lot, whether it be still as a player, but also I think as a mentor to a lot of young fellas. You know, he's been there. He's been, you know, he's been the poster boy for Australian rugby for a long period of time. And then he's had a few falls from grace, but he's managed to get back up. And I think the more we can keep guys like that in the environment, the better.
Yeah, I also think, like, from a Indigenous perspective, there's not enough Indigenous players in Australian rugby. There's only been, I think, 13 or 14 that have played for the Wallabies. More needs to be done to encourage Indigenous representation. This is a guy who's played 95 tests. I think Australian rugby needs to do everything they can to keep Kirtley involved in rugby. That was a slight tangent. Let's get back to Super Rugby. But he's also a goal kicker that's won games and,
he is,
you know, put on time, lost games, missed opportunities against the Lions.
He kicked one in the high belt, didn't he, to win way back in Bloemfontein, I think. He knows. He's been there.
So Joe Schmidt today was up for media, the release of the British and Irish Lions tickets. And there was representation from Phil Waugh down in Melbourne. There was Dan Herbert up in Brisbane, the Rugby Show chairman. Representation in Adelaide and Perth, all cities that are going to host Lions fixtures. Joe Roth was down in Canberra. Joe Schmidt didn't want to, he was keeping his cards really close to his chest in terms of players around the assistant coaches, around national eligibility. You were spoken about that recently. Sarah is one guy that you've spoken about who you think could play a part. Are there any others that might play a part in a Wallabies coached side by Joe Schmidt this year?
Yeah, look, I think that you know, your usual suspects. I think, you know, Tate's looking good, Fraser's looking good, Harry's looking good from the Reds' perspective. I think making sure that we have a model that develops to test match, because I think they are different beasts. Super Rugby is not test match rugby, so making sure that we understand that, and I'm sure, you know, Joe's all over that. It is in a weird, it's a double-edged sword. You know, Joe had a press conference today. I didn't know about it. I bet you if it was Eddie, we would know about it, because he does bring eyeballs. He says outlandish things. It's entertaining. But I'm sure Joe's head down, bum up, and making sure he's getting the best coaching staff, the best players. And, we've got to trust him, I guess.
Well, one of the things that he made mention of was that talent. He said it can be, we've got to look past talent at times almost. It can be fickle. Do you think that Australian rugby's picked on talent too much and gone past the consistent players, the toilers perhaps, that do the right thing, you know, time after time after time again?
Yeah, 100%. And look, it's probably a bit self-serving, because I wasn't the most talented, but I'd like to think, like, particularly like a Brumbies point of view, we're very, very big on consistency, very big on defence, breakdown, work rate, work ethic, these kind of things. And ultimately we felt that's what set us apart at the time. And at test match level, everyone's talented. Like other than your one-off players, your Israel Folau's or whatever, everyone's very talented. And what actually separates you is character, is grit, is mentality. And you look at the South Africans, you know, just the fact that they felt they were playing for a deeper thing for South Africa and all this, it really, in a weird way, it did probably separate that. And so, yeah, I 100% think that we've got to look at different elements. I think rugby's tricky in Australia. We have such a congested, you know, sporting market. So we're always looking for the new shiny toy, but the answer's often a bit boring.
It's a tricky one, you're right. Yeah. Well, it's a tricky one, but also, you know, look at the Waratahs on the weekend. A 12-10 defeat to the Blues. It wasn't necessarily the prettiest of games, but it's another 2-point loss to New Zealand, and it's just a tough one to then get everyone to roll back the week after to support your side when you've got back-to-back defeats, but also against New Zealand opposition. So it's a great thing that Queensland is going well. They're very much in the top four, the Brumbies having a really great win against the Highlanders. We're going to talk about that more after, but right now we're going to go to Fiji to speak to their Drua coach, Mick Byrne. Well, it's a very warm welcome to the Fiji Drua coach, former Wallabies and All Blacks assistant, a man that's been pretty much everywhere and played pretty much every game, Mick the Kick Byrne. How are you, Mick?
Christy, I'm very good, thank you.
Probably should be saying Bulla Vanaka. It's what everyone says when they're speaking to someone either Fijian or related to Fijian rugby. Is a Bulla Vanaka.
Yeah, Bulla Vanaka.
How is the Fijian, Mick? Does it go much beyond that?
Not much past. There's a bit there, and you know, it's like anything. You have to be talking it all the time.
Is it like Japan? We have translators, and that most of the boys would be English speaking, or most of
yeah, and that's English. And you tend to get a bit lazy because of it. And if I was to stay on here past this year, I would certainly invest in some lessons. I mean the players speak English. It's a second language, though, so we use a lot of players that are great, especially the boys that have been overseas, to help translate what we're saying in English to translate back into Fijian to get the understanding and learn to talk a little bit slower so that they can get it as well. So yeah, you are spoilt because they work so hard and they listen so well that you just tend to sort of get trapped into just staying English. But definitely if I go past this year, I'll be investing in some lessons.
Hey, Mick, before we get to Fijian rugby and talking all things Drua, can you tell us and put a story to bed, or perhaps tell us if it's true? Did you invent the Adidas ball?
Invent it?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't invent the Adidas ball. That was invented 100 years ago, but certainly in 2005, we went to Germany and they had an existing ball that had been developed and the valve was in the panel. And I'd suggested to our Adidas reps in New Zealand that the valve should be in the seam, which makes the ball more balanced and fly better through the air. And it's the same as the old Summit ball. It had the valve in the panel and it's basically more than 60% of the weight of the ball is in the valve. So if you've got it in the weakest part of the ball, which is the middle of the panel, and I'm sure your listeners don't want to get caught up in a scientific understanding of a football, but if you stick it in the seam, which is the strongest part of it, I know you and I, we like to just go on our own here. You know? I think if you keep it in the seam, where it's the strongest part of the ball, it has its most advantage, you know. So when we went to Adidas, they said, oh, look, we've gone down this road and Gilbert have a patent on it in the seam. And I said, well, I can't because the Sharon has a valve in the seam. So you have to investigate it further. And we had a couple of heated discussions with the Adidas legal counsel because they didn't want to waste any more time on it, which is fair enough. You know, rugby is not a massive part of Adidas. You know, it's a small little component. But they are really loyal and they're a great sponsor. But rugby's not a big part of it. So they didn't want to invest too much time. But they had one last crack and they went in and I said, look, it can't be that you can't put it in the seam. The patent's probably how it's put in the seam. So they invested the patent even deeper and then they went, yeah, we can put it in there. So that's it. It started. I had about 13 prototypes. We mixed up latex and rubber and I went over to Germany. We're kicking it out of tunnels and I remember the first year I got six prototypes built and I took DC and Mills down to the park with these balls and I put up a bomb with one of the balls and it was like a super ball. It hit the ground and it just went back up in the air and they're waiting for it to come down. I said, oh, I might be a bit too much latex in that one, so we might have to take it. So we ended up playing around and we found the ball that spun perfectly, held its line, the valve created like an engine. So every time that rotated, whether it be a drop punt shape or a spiral, every time it went around, it created its own little engine for more spin and more momentum through the air. So, yeah, we did that. And then we took it to Heineken Cup a couple of years later and they handed it out to all the participants of the Heineken Cup and all the kickers there, they loved it. And they said, this ball feels great. Hookers got it. They said it felt great. They said the hookers said it felt a little bit light for them, but it's actually the same weight as the Gilbert ball. It just felt light because I think of the the shape. We had a little bit of a different shape, plus also the mixture of latex and rubber was different.
I reckon the grip as well. The grip
yeah,
was, it was, yeah. Yeah. It was, it's a, the, it's hard work well, like invested well, because one thing about playing when you play the Kiwis in New Zealand, for anyone listening, is that you play them with a Adidas ball, and whilst you're probably going to get dusted in New Zealand, it's good for your kicking stats because you the ball, you know, it flew so true, and particularly if you're playing in Dunedin, God, it was a, it's interesting that it hasn't actually gone further because they're cracking balls.
Yeah, and I think we put it into the World Cup, but I think Gilbert has a really strong relationship with World Rugby, and you know, good luck to them. They've structured that up, and they've been great supporters of rugby. But yeah, I'm a bit biased there, Pup, but I agree the Adidas ball does travel well. I remember I got served, Graham Henry gave me a serve in 2000, and I think it might have been 8 or 9 when Francois Steyn kicked one from about 60 metres at Hamilton that went through to win the test match. Graham didn't talk to me for a couple of weeks.
He didn't mention that DC kicked 5 from 5 as well. So
yeah, that's right. And he also didn't mention that Francois Steyn kicks that distance on any field he kicks
exactly.
on.
Exactly.
I did. So that was a really exciting time for me to get involved with that, and you know, always came back with a couple of bags of gear from the Adidas factory. So that was a bonus as well.
It's always pretty fascinating, I think, when you put golfers and take them to the, you know, get fitted out, or cricketers when they go get their bats and you know, the Kookaburra balls. But there's a nice little bit of intel around Mick Byrne and his involvement with Adidas rugby. Hey, Mick, big things happening with the Drua, and we just, you're going to be hosting the Waratahs this weekend, which will be an opportunity to get back on track. But just Fijian rugby, we know that the Flying Fijians made the quarterfinals last year at the World Cup, came off the back of the Drua making the quarterfinals themselves. It's a real explosion of rugby that's happening in Fiji at the moment. Have you noticed a difference since the World Cup and the players returning and just rugby on the islands itself?
Yeah, I think one of the things, actually, we went and did our Itatau, which is our visit the president of Fiji, which is a very formal occasion where before you go on the road as a team, all the teams do it, international teams where you're traveling, go and meet the president and you get his well wishes, and it's a very formal occasion. It's actually, it's a very good experience. And when he spoke about watching, he said he's watched the prime minister travel around the country and, you know, through the 1,100 odd provinces and villages of Fiji. And he said every time Prime Minister was there and people in the background, doesn't matter where, what village they went to in Fiji, they had Drua shirts on. And he said, so having their own team on the island has been massive for them. And I think when we played the Chiefs in that first year, when we had that game at home, and that was the last game of the year, I think it was, and we played the Chiefs at home. When you looked into the crowd, there was more Chiefs jerseys than in Drua jerseys, because we'd been based in Australia at Lennox. And when you looked around the crowd, there was Crusaders jerseys, Hurricanes jerseys, Chiefs jerseys, and a sprinkling of Drua jerseys, because we hadn't been there, you know, and suddenly we're at home, they had a team, and then it just took off the next year. It's one of the biggest selling jerseys in Super Rugby. I was speaking to my son the other day, he was walking down the Corso and he bumped into three people with and Drua jerseys on. They're like, well, he said, well, we were over in Fiji and we just loved the Drua, and you know, Waratahs is our team, but got a great jersey and we bought the jersey. So I think the excitement of having the own team in Fiji has got a lot of people behind the team. And then topping that off with a good performance at the Rugby World Cup, it's created a real lot of excitement around. And look, can Fijians get any more excited by rugby than they are? I don't know, but
it's almost a bit like the, what they say, the Indian cricket team never play an away game. Like the Drua doesn't seem supporter wise that they play an away game on the weekend you saw against in Hamilton. The Fijians go nuts in the crowd, and it's added something to Super Rugby that we haven't had in so long.
Yeah, you're right, Pop. I think, you know, wherever we travel, we've got that crowd. The boys really appreciate it. They're loud too, you know. They express themselves and they're loud and enjoy. They enjoy it. There's a party type atmosphere at the rugby, and I think when you go into a lot of rugby environments, that I'm not saying it is, but you know, the old tweed jacket. There's a lot more to rugby supporters than that. But they are very traditionally they appreciate the game and they're there to watch the game. And the Fijian people are there to have a great time, and they're going to watch the game. They get excited by it, but they're there to have a good time. And I think that's something that they do no matter where. And, you know, for people, you know, that for the Fijians that are living in wherever they are in New Zealand or Australia, to have their team come to their part of the world, that's even more exciting for them, and they come out in force. And certainly the crowds at home are exceptional, but we do get that feeling that there's a lot of support when we travel. We just got to get our act together on the road as rugby team and start winning some of those games to reward them, you know.
Mick, I was reading Ben Ryan's book recently. For those who don't know, he coached the Fijians to their first Olympic gold ever. And he spoke a lot about the psychology of Fijian players being a lot different than what he'd experienced there in England. And, you know, you've coached All Blacks and Wallabies. I'm interested to know if you've found that. I know playing with a lot of the Fijian boys, they, you know, oversimplifying it, don't like training but love playing, just like a massive competitors. And I don't know, how have you found the boys adapt? Have you had to change your coaching style, or what have you found different?
I've changed my coaching style, but I mean, you can probably challenge me on this. I've never been a hard ass coach, and I've always tried to put the players first. And when I started as a head coach, I found myself actually not doing that. You know, I thought being the head coach, I needed to be a little bit more direct, and that was probably the mistake I made the first year, not being myself as a coach. So that I learned pretty quickly that they're not going to respond to that sort of coaching. So it was actually my style, my natural style of working with players and helping them, and is actually something that works well here for the players. I've got to be mindful that they, you know, when we started. Yeah, you know, I understand what you're saying about the training you've played with guys and played with them Super Rugby and in the national team, and they love turning up and playing, but you know, when you've got one or two or possibly three in the team, you might be able to get away with someone standing on the wing who hasn't really taken on board a lot of the work during the week, but he comes out and kills it on the wing. But when you've got 47 of them across the park, you help them understand how to prepare and how to work. And when we first started, a lot of the work off the training track was difficult. You know, we were at Lennox and we brought a whole set of Apple computers and we stuck them up on the bench, and our team room looked awesome, but there was no one in it. And then Tevita Kanaviri, he was in there every night, and so people started to come with him. And then all of a sudden, year two, and now it's they're all sitting around the computers. You know, towards the end of last year, you come in every day, they're sitting around the computers before training. During lunch, they're sitting around talking in groups, and you know, it's just inspiring to watch them because it's something they've never done before. And also their fitness levels have improved so much. We're fitter than we were in year two. We were fitter than we were in year one. And now in year three, we're fitter than we were in year two. And you know, we've been able to, you know, while we didn't start well, I thought we started well against the Blues, as in the first 4 minutes. You know, we had 23 phases and we dropped the ball over the try line, and then we didn't touch the ball again until the 22nd minute. And in that time, we gave away 8 penalties and 17 points. And we came back and we outscored them in the second half. Moano, I think we just, you know, we missed the beat there to start that game. But we came back and outscored them in the second half. The Crusaders, we were 7-0 down, came back and kept them to zero in the second half. And then on the weekend, we had a lapse just after halftime where Chiefs got a couple of good tries, but that last 20 minutes, we came back and we played out the game. So we're actually really good shape physically now. So we're training a lot better. You know, our training has been really physical. It's very hard not to be with this team. You know, you'll say shoulders on, and within 5 minutes, there's guys getting smashed. You know, so we just you know, there's no holding them back, and they're training really well, and they've got themselves fitter than they've ever been, and they're really enjoying that. You know, they're enjoying being able to just go again and repeat efforts. So, yeah, it was a challenge to start with because they'd never done it before, but they've taken to it and they're working extremely hard every day.
It's extraordinary some of the talent that comes out of the islands, and you think about your wingers there and probably the most exciting players in Super Rugby just about. But Matt and I were talking before you jumped on, and he was making mention of a great anecdote with Brad Fittler when I think it was maybe a baggage handler that ends up playing rugby league shortly after. But you spoke about the rise in Drua jerseys all across the islands. What about from a talent ID perspective and seeing rugby in terms of translating into more people playing? Can you see that? Is there data to reflect more people playing? And have you even come across people playing on the beach or footy fields that you've gone, hang on a moment, why don't you come train or come through the pathways that Fiji's got now?
Yeah, well, I don't know the data. You know, that's probably a Fiji rugby sort of thing. You know, we're certainly involved in the development pathways because we are a professional pathway for the Fijian young players coming through. We set up a development, for want of a bit of a name, you know, academy for the Ndrua. We had 11 players in its first year, and we've put five of those into the main team. And then this year we've got another, we replace those with another batch coming through. And I think we've got our sights pretty strong on that 20s program, you know, the ones that go into the 20s. And we signed, you know, three, four players from last year's 20s team to our squad. It's the next level down that we need to get more involved in. You know, we're looking at setting up an academy for the 15 and 16 year olds and start to find them. And we're looking at, you know, who's out there that could help us do that. We're working closely with Fiji Rugby. And, you know, to be fair, Fiji Rugby, obviously we're a great part of that, but with the national team protocols around where you can pick, you know, a young player gets snapped off the island and goes to Toulon, you know, Fiji Rugby keep an eye on him and he gets developed over there and his game improves dramatically and he becomes a really good player for Toulon. He can still play for the Flying Fijians. Yes, there's Reg 9 and yes, there's a few other things, but we're trying to make sure that we capture those good ones into the Drua pathway for us. And we know we're not going to be able to hang on to them all. You know, we lost a couple this year. We've got everybody signed up for next year. There's a couple that are exposed at the end of 25. And then there's two or three exposed at the end of 26. So keeping that pathway on the island going is probably a big driver for me, because if we can keep those young players coming through and staying at home, and it just creates that atmosphere around their local village. And, you know, we know we're not going to be able to hang on to them all. You know, the Reds couldn't hang on to, you know, Samu at his peak. The Rebels couldn't hang on to Marika at his peak. We're not going to be Charles Piatau left at his, he was just starting to hit his straps in New Zealand and he left, you know. So Super Rugby can't actually compete with some of the big dollars that come in from overseas. But whereas, you know, the Melbourne might lose Marika and the Reds lose Samu, we've got, you know, 40 of them that are being looked at from all around the world. So it's a big challenge for us to hang on to all our Fijian players because they are attractive to overseas clubs. And, you know, Mark Evans and Nico Andrade, who's our general manager, Mark Evans, our CEO, have done a tremendous job in being able to lock away our players for the next couple of years. And we'll continue to develop and we'll work with Fiji Rugby Union's pathway to create a, you know, like a block line, if you like, into the development of professional rugby players on the island.
I know you'll pass the kudos off to the players and all that, but your coaching staff in particular, Glenn Jackson, you're like quite innovative. And I could, you know, I was talking to Christy before this. I played against Glenn Jackson. I was refereed by Glenn Jackson, and then I played against a team coached by him. And you look what Russie's doing. He's getting Jaco Piper on board. You look at what the French are doing as well. They're getting a lot of that referee input. Just as a coaching staff, what kind of role does he play? How advantageous is that? Because it's quite an interesting one.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, I coached Jacko at Saracens. He came over there in his first year. I coached him in his first year in England, and he brought an innovative way of thinking into Saracens. And at the time, you know, they'd sort of, I don't know what you, won't be too strong on a word, they moved Kayfon, and sort of I took a more active role in the back line, and having someone like Jacko there, even at that early stage, you know, I know he'd done his time in New Zealand, but he still had a number of years to go in England, and he had a really good way of looking at the game, and he was innovative, and obviously as a ref, when he went into reffing, he took that innovation and that understanding of the game into his reffing, and I thought he was a very good ref. I thought he was a great ref. And now working with him as a coach, having gone full circle as a player, coaching him as a player and now coaching with him as a coach, he's great. He sees the game just like you, Pup, you know, like in that position, you know, you see the game, you see what it's all about, you know, and you're the same. You know, you always saw lots of opportunity out there, you know, and I think it's having the team that can maximise those opportunities as well, you know, so he's always challenging the team. He's coming up with some great things, and our players are learning a lot about the game because of the way Jacko coaches, you know, and then Greg Fleming, Ford's coach, you know, he coached the New Zealand under 20 scrum a couple of years ago, and he's a coach, a Ford's coach, but he's an educator. You know, they both, he and Glenn, and why I liked him, and, you know, maybe it's their sort of going through that New Zealand pathways where there's, you know, a long time ago they started on this coach to coaches, but it was, you know, putting the athlete first, you know, and helping coaches understand getting the best out of your players is by asking questions and developing them and developing their knowledge, not necessarily going and telling them what needs to happen, but asking them what their thoughts are. And both those coaches are brilliant at that, you know, and so our players are learning every time we go into the training track. Our players are being asked questions, legitimate questions about learning, and they have to learn. And, you know, when you've got an innovative coach like Jacko who sees the game really, really well, and Greg's a great forwards coach. We brought in Al Rogers this year in defence, you know. So our players are always constantly learning on the training track. They're getting asked a lot of questions by the coaches, and they're having to go away and sort it all out. And that's sort of the way we've been coaching. So I'm really lucky to have that sort of coaching staff that are aligned with me. As Pup knows, I quite like that style of coaching where we ask a lot of questions and help the players, you know, try and find the answers for themselves. And if they can't, we're there to help them. And I like that style, and that's working well for us.
Mick, last week Matt and I were talking about the national side and how much we wish that the Flying Fijians were part of the Rugby Championship. We think it would give a fair bit of colour and oxygen and also a competitiveness. That Fiji, particularly if they were hosting a game, would provide. From your perspective, how far away do you think the Flying Fijians, from a high-performance perspective, would be? Would they compete, and do you think that they should be included in the Rugby Championship going forward?
Yeah, I think they definitely should. I read somewhere where that's probably not going to happen for a while now. I think Sands are, you know, you don't know, you only read, don't you? You don't know what was a comment made that expansion's probably not going to happen at the next look. But the way that the Drua boys have learnt over the last two or three years to prepare, they are now, you know, professional rugby players. They turn up in the morning before training. Every single one of them is doing activation. They're in the gym working, working on individual parts of their game, individual things. If, you know, they got rehab, they're all working. And they're there, you know, 45 minutes before we start the day. They're in the gym doing lots of little things, which the professional players do. The real good professional players do a lot of work on their body and keep themselves going. They're in looking at the computers. They're working really hard. So the talent they have is now being matched by their professional attitude to the game. And when those two things really click into gear, and they're not far away from doing that, this team whether it be the Ndrua or the Flying Fijians. It might be another one, it might be another 2 years, but when that all clicks together and the clinical parts of their game, the skill aspects of the game and their game awareness and knowledge meets their talent, they're going to be a formidable team, both as a Super Rugby team, and that might be in another 2 or 3 years' time, that might be after me, you know, and the Flying Fijians, you know, we're looking at that. If that's 226, that's definitely they're going to be in the same shape, because the Northern Hemisphere players are already in that professional environment. They're already contributing. They just came out of a World Cup. You know, we won't go into Australia's woes leading into that, but they nearly beat Wales as well, you know. Now, Wales have got a wooden spoon in this year's Six Nations, so you know, maybe comparing them to those two teams in that year may not be that, but they should have beaten Wales. They could have beaten Wales. They beat Australia, and then they Georgia and Portugal. Who knows? You know, like maybe they just felt that they were going to win that. But that's the professionalism that I'm talking about. Their ability to turn up and be ready to play, like they were ready to play against Australia, against any opposition. The day that that happens will be the day either the Ndrua and the Fiji national team will have a lot of success.
Yeah, that's interesting, the missing element of what's needed to make that next step. But you've coached with the All Blacks and you coached with the Wallabies. Do you feel like the Rugby Championship's a bit stale and does need a breath of fresh air and some more vibrance into it?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing about the Rugby Championship is the travel. You know, I think that's a challenge. And, you know, there's three opponents. So, you know, I think having another couple of opponents in there would be awesome. A Fijian team in there would be awesome as well, because, you know, that whole concept of another exciting brand of rugby being put into the Rugby Championship, I think we've seen it with Super Rugby. You know, I know there's been commentators calling for a Bulla round rather than the Super round in Melbourne. They're calling for a Bulla round. Well, you know, that would be awesome. You know, if we could house all the teams and give them training pitches and work there, that'd be awesome. But that's the excitement that Fiji Rugby bring, and they're at a point now where they need to continue their growth. They need to take the next step and develop that. And, you know, if they were given the opportunity to be in the Rugby Championship post 2026, they would absolutely add value to that competition.
It's an interesting one, as you mentioned earlier, Christy, about high performance. Would Fiji be able to, like, high performance wise? I think Fiji 100%. It's no doubt about it. They would be competitive. And then you look at someone like Japan, where it's high performance is probably the question mark, but they've got the business case. Now, if Fiji had the business case, you know, if we somehow could match those two, like there's two teams there that could really add a lot to the Rugby Championship. You think of the Japanese crowd and the Fijian crowd, like they're very tribal in their own way, very polite over here. You know, the Fijians may be a bit louder, but it 100%, if we could somehow match them up, it would add so much to our game.
I think, honestly, you know, here, living here and seeing how much growth this team's had in such a short period of time, you know, for them to then take that next step into the Rugby Championship, yeah, that would challenge them. It would challenge them professionally from the point of view of, you know, getting the ground ready for international standards, you know, all those things. But if you take that, there's another batch of money that comes into the organisation that can be utilised into those facilities to help with the grounds, to help with the facilities, to create opportunities for visiting teams to have a good experience when they come to Fiji. So, yeah, I think it'd be awesome.
Mick, just last one before you go. I love the curtains behind you. It's very much 1960s kind of style. They're a bit like your ilk.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit dark, but if you saw behind those curtains, it's probably that's a 1 out of 10, but behind those curtains is a 10 out of 10. You need to do your podcast.
What's her name?
2 o'clock in the afternoon. You need to do your podcast at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I'll open the curtains and then you'll go.
It's 4 o'clock here in Japan, mate.
Jealous of that bloke. I wish I was living where he was living. But then I close the curtains and it is very much, you know, a very humble abode, Christy, very humble.
Yeah. So what do you do when you get home from training? Your family's still in Oz, largely from my understanding. Is it by the beach? For those that might be thinking about heading to Fiji for the Drua game, like obviously there's a lot to do, but for you, like, is it fishing? Like, how do you get away from the game and just relax as well?
Well, I've got a bottle of Jack Daniel's Sinatra up there. That helps me relax. I play golf, mate. I play golf. So my afternoon is pup nose, you know. I'm playing off six now, pup, so I'm nearly as good as you.
Oh, much better than me. No,
I'm down to six, enjoying my golf. I probably get a game in a week if I can. It's, I haven't played for 3 weeks. You know, we've been travelling and different things, but I try and get a game in where I can, and I enjoy that. Other than that, I live 5 minutes from the training ground, so, you know, I'll do a workout after training like tonight, come back here and Sinatra's there, and I just put my feet up and do a little bit of work on the computer and head back in tomorrow and go again.
I can tell you, Christy, there's not much time that Mick's not thinking or talking rugby. Even though he's on the golf course, he loves it. He's obsessed by it. That's why he's good.
Probably fair call up. But, I actually enjoy, I know this is going to sound really anal, but I actually enjoy working on my own, just sitting here, not in the office, you know, and then maybe get up and go and get another Frank and come back. But, you know, at the end of the day, I just like being able to do my own thing around the work. And I've got great coaches, work extremely hard. So that really helps me relax when I come home at night, you know. And I learned a long time ago about the story about the Midwestern farmer who was looking for a farmhand just before the big strong winds came through the Midwest. And he interviewed this young kid and he didn't have a lot of experience, but the farmer said to him, well, why should I employ you? And he said, because I can sleep when the wind blows. And the farmer's like, what? Anyway, he went through all the other guys and none of them could work at this late notice, so he employed this young bloke. Anyway, he'd been there about 4 weeks and the winds came in this night and the farmer's bedroom window was slapping up against the wall and woke him up. And the winds are here. So he locked up his bedroom window. Then he ran down the back and he went to lock up the corral and it was already locked. And he went to the stables to shut the stable door and it was already locked. And he ran around and there's the stable hand asleep. He's like, what? And he goes, so in the morning he says to him, mate, where were you last night? Like, the winds came in and I had to go around and check everything. And he said, yeah. He said, was everything locked up? He said, it was. And he said, well, I told you, I can sleep when the wind blows. And so as a coach, I can sleep when the wind blows because I've got great coaching staff. We do our work. We prepare well. And there's no reason why when the wind starts to blow at the end of the week, we can sleep well. And
I reckon the Sinatra helps you sleep as well, yeah, just quietly.
Well, it does. I can't argue with it.
Hey, Mick, we could talk all day or in your case all night, but thanks for joining the Rural Rugby Podcast. And yeah, it's great to have you involved in Super Rugby. Looking forward to having you back in Oz and good luck against the Stars.
Great with you two guys. Spent lots of time enjoying your company and worked with Pup and enjoyed coaching him. He's a great player to work with. Thoroughly enjoyed working with him, and you've always kept things honest, mate. You've always challenged, and I've enjoyed that. So next time we do it, can you do it in 2 in the afternoon? I'll open my curtains and you'll go, wow, that's Fiji.
Jealous.
Promise you.
Thanks
that.
A lot.
All right.
Thanks awesome, a lot, mate. Man. Doing great. Thanks. Right. All the best this week. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, always good to talk to Mick, and he's so generous with his time, but also I think a great communicator and a fella that I would like, a coach that I'd like to see when his next coaching appointment is, or whether or not it's a high performance, I'd love to see Mick Byrne back in Australian rugby because I think he's got a lot to give.
Yeah, look, I'm really biased with this. I spent a lot of time with Mick in, I think it's 2018 and 19, with the World Cup, and we spent countless hours just chewing the fat. You saw there, Mick can talk and so can I. And we'll just get right into detail of you know, boring things for most normal people, but we're just the biggest rugby nerds. And he's a special man, a special coach, a guy who has like a mountain of experience, a mountain of knowledge that, like, you know, once again, we've kind of let sit through our fingers a little bit. I think look back to 2019, we actually had Mick Byrne and Simon on our coaching staff, and, you know, now they're doing amazing things for Fiji.
Yeah, Simon Raluiz as well as Michael Checker leads Argentina to the to the World Cup semi-finals. You had a nice kind of moment with Mick as well at the end of the 2019 World Cup too.
Yeah, Mick was really good to me and meant a lot to me personally on a personal level. Just, you know, obviously coached a lot, but yeah, brought a lot of passion and you know, he's always meant a lot. I actually gave him my playing jersey from our last game against England in the quarterfinal. It just was like a gesture of like a small thing I could do to him. And I'm not sure if it's gathering dust out the back or something, but no, just, yeah, he's a guy who knows a lot, who and you saw him when he's talking there, he's just talking about the nitty-gritty, isn't he? He's talking about the day-to-day, the grassroots. He's not talking about these big outlandish ideas. He's talking about professionalism, about repeat efforts, about coming in early, about leaving late. And, yeah, I really like it. He's a special man.
I can see him hanging up the jersey next to the bottle of Jack Daniels that he was talking about, maybe not in Fiji, but back home in Noosa where he lives, maybe in the billiard room there if he's got one. But yeah, it was awesome to talk to Mick. Hey, they've got a big clash this weekend because it's both the Waratahs and Fiji have only won the one match from their opening four games. The winner will leapfrog each other. Who do you see coming out on top of this one?
I think the fact that it's in Fiji, I think you've got to say that the Fijians would be the favourites. In saying that, though, like the Tars are a much improved team, aren't they? Like I know it's easy to look at win-loss record, but you'd feel the same seeing the Tars in the first few games. They look a better team than they were last year.
Yeah, they do. The big questions are whether or not Darren Coleman's going to be given the opportunity to stay there as head coach. And he's actually handed a lot of the responsibilities of the head coaching to off the back of feedback, which wasn't necessarily great at the end of last year, handed those responsibilities a lot to Jason Gilmore, who is defence coach in his assistant role aspect. But Darren's also been kind of filling in as the general manager with Andrew Blades moving on last year. So I just wonder whether or not it just sounds and the feel of it might be that Darren Coleman, with the decision that was supposed to be made by the end of March around who's going to be next year's coach, I just wonder whether or not Coleman will try to position himself to be the general manager going forward. And from my understanding and dealing with player agents, he's doing quite a good job in that space. So that'll be fascinating because it's a big year next year with the Lions and the Waratahs. They are a side that needs to perform given the population, given the business community, given Rugby Australia's headquarters, the pathways. The Tars need to fire more often than they don't.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a bee in my bonnet, to be honest. The general manager and coach roles not being separated or not being clearly distinguished in Australian rugby particularly. I think we're very amateur in how we kind of have our head coach and he fronts the press and he also does selecting, but he also, talks to player agents and it feels quite amateur. If you look at other sports, or have a sporting director, we've finally got Peter Horn now in a role at Rugby Australia, but that needs to translate further down. Like we can't be having a head coach going, oh, actually, can you pick that up? Can you pick that up? Like, it needs to be quite specific because how do you have a guy going into a season like this with all these questions around his future and players, and it's unnecessary. I'd like to see some stability there because they're clearly moving in the right direction, but it's a hard competition. It takes time.
Yeah, it certainly is. So watch this space over the next couple of weeks around the Waratahs, but heading to, I think it's Churchill Park in Lakotoka, good luck to any visiting team. We know that Fiji knocked off the Crusaders, but last year I think it was both the Crusaders, Scott Robinson's side then, but the Hurricanes too, I think they dusted them. So, that'll be a very entertaining game on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, it will. As you say, very tough to win over there. So it'll be exciting to watch.
We've spoken about the Reds. We'll just touch upon the Brumbies as well because they're a side that finally, I think, started to show what they're capable of. A really good, gritty win against the Highlanders. They take on Moana Pacifica, who are coming off the back of the win themselves. Kopi Kepu, I think he scored a try. Good to see him smile after a really tough 2023. But Christian Leifano also played his part too.
Yeah, the offset piece too. I think both tries were was a tap move, so Kopi scores. And then a little throw over the top. Christian winds back the ears and gives an offload on the inside. So, yeah, it's good to see a few Aussies winning those games. Yeah, look, I thought the Brumbies were pretty good. I thought they got a result, maybe not the performance they were, you know, aiming for, but a result, and that's the important thing. And it might have been a Pyrrhic victory because, you know, Blake Shoup's gone down, Ikitau's gone down, and that might be a bit concerning going forward. But the fact that they're winning is really important, and you can always, it's always a lot easier to build from there. So hopefully nothing too serious with those guys out.
Yeah, you're not wrong. The Ikitau one, I know that Ollie Sapsford, I think he's a much better suited player to outside centre than inside centre. But, yeah, when you lose a shop and you've already got an Alan Alatoa out, it really tests your front row. Just on the Brumbies, I thought they brought a fair bit more physicality. We saw Rob Valentini have one of his stronger games, but even a Caden Neville, I thought he was really good. And we know that the Brumbies line out, their defensive line out, has been working well, perhaps not so much their attacking line out.
Yeah, and we're probably comparing that to past years when it's been such a weapon. I thought something that was really good to see was the Brumbies in the last 20. You know, they haven't been great this year, but in the last 20, you saw Reece Van Nett come on, some crucial scrum penalties. We saw a line-out more try. I think the commentator said first since round 11 last year or something. So some really characteristic things, traditionally characteristic of the Brumbies, some strong set-piece impacts, and in particular from the bench. So I think that's a good sign going forward.
Next weekend, you got the Hurricanes, the Rebels. It's going to be a tough one for the Rebels off the back of a poor result against the Reds, where they just didn't really show up and they were probably lazy, particularly around the breakdown, around the ruck. Can you see any other results, or is that a big one for the Canes?
Yeah, look, the Reds game, the Rebels were clearly a step or two off. But just emotionally, it looked they looked like they lacked a little bit of impact. You know, second half we might have got a little bit excited when it might have become a little bit of a game. But no, the Rebels look like a fatigued team at the moment. I think it's hard at the best of times when all engines are firing to go over Wellington and turn them over. But I think it might be a long night, unfortunately.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think the Brumbies will be too strong for Moana Pacifica. The Drua game we've spoken about, that's going to be a cracker at 12:05 Oceania and daylight time. A couple of really, really exciting New Zealand derbies to look forward to, and then the Force and Reds. And the Reds will definitely be wanting to kick on before hosting the Brumbies a week later and trying to draw a big, big crowd.
Yeah, and complete two different sides and situations at the moment. You know, you've got the Reds flying. You know, they've drawn one match basically, and they've won every other one. And whereas you got the Force, who had three pretty good outings, I thought, and then on the weekend, wheels fell off a little bit. So I think you'll see a response from them. I think, you know, the fact that it's over in Perth, the Force might be able to get a little bit of an upset, but at the moment, I think this Les Kiss coach team will be too strong.
All right, Matt, last thing. Six Nations wrapped up over the weekend and it finished with a cracker between France and England. France and Fabien Gauthier's side too strong in the end. I think it was a late penalty that saw the French win in Lyon, which was the scene and the stadium of the demise for the Wallabies last year against Wales. But Wales are in all sorts, having, you know, got the wooden spoon of the Six Nations, and Australia's going to be taking them on in a few months' time. That's one to look forward to pencil in. Tell me, does this Australian side, it's going to be, obviously, there's going to be so many changes, including the coach, but Australian fans should be pretty confident going into a couple of games against Wales, right? It's the perfect first couple of matches for a new coach like Joe Schmidt?
Yeah, like I thought that about the World Cup last year as well. I thought, oh, look, we're not in the best place, you know, in terms of a team, but we've got a relatively easy pool, and then that got flipped over. So, look, you'd like to think there'd be some confidence there. I thought that last match, England-France, was an absolute ripper. The French are just they play so different than any other team, I think, in world rugby. And they're so good to watch. And I dare say it's probably a lot of the frustration for the fans at times too. But, geez, they're good to watch. Some of those tries and, oh, ridiculous.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was good to see. Lewis Leiner, 2 from 2. Oh, I can't believe it. He's got to have the highest winning percentage of any Italian player of all time. But fair play to Lewis, who made the switch from Harlequins to, I think, Benetton. But congratulations.
Mate, if he's listening, Lewis, put the cue on the rack. It does not get any better than that, I promise you, mate. It's he's done amazing, and it was good to see his dad. He had to choose between that and Melbourne, which game to go to. But it's awesome to see. I actually met Lewis when he was a young fella over in England. So it's really cool seeing guys like that do well at such a high level.
I think 70,000 at the Principality is probably slightly better than 200 people at Amy Park at the moment.
Yeah, you're not counting the seagulls though at Amy Park. There's none of them in Rome.
Yeah, true. Or under the roof in Cardiff. The last one, Ireland, Six Nations Grand Slam, Six Nations champions, not Grand Slam champions, but Six Nations champions. Impressive kind of gutsy win. It was hard for they scrape over the line against Scotland, but not only is it back-to-back Six Nations for Ireland, but the end of an era with David Nusafora leaving Ireland. He's coming back to Australia after the Olympics, where he's going to be a consultant in the high performance area, probably working alongside Peter Horn, Joe Schmidt, who he knows from his Irish days so well. I don't know how much you know of David, but it's a heck of a legacy that he leaves. Other than the fact that they didn't win a World Cup or make a semi, the amount of Six Nations titles, climbing to number one in the world rankings, you've got to say they've had a massive turnaround under Nusafora.
Yeah, and look, as a director of high performance or general manager, his role is that consistency. It's not that one off. And so for him to be number one that throughout, you know, for a couple of years now, just says that's his job basically. And he's done an amazing job at it considering where he came from. And another guy who's fallen through, I think, is a little bit, who's slipped through the cracks. An Aussie coach who we've had here, who coached the Blues, the Brumbies. I had Nussi actually at under 20s in 2009 and 2010, and he was well and truly in our system. So to see him go over there and do amazing things is, it's nice, sure, but it irks a little bit.
It'll be fascinating to see what a David Nusafora. It might be 2.0, it might be 3.0 back in Australian rugby, but if he can bring the consistency that he's brought and perhaps the hard edge that Australian rugby probably needs, and someone really, I don't know if centralisation is around the corner, but they're heading that way, and he's someone that will be able to give, I think, huge amount of direction around decision-making, and it's probably needed, I think.
Oh, yeah. I remember there was a while ago, it might have been Steve Moore. There was talk of him going to an Irish club at the time, and it got vetoed by IRFU, you know. And so, like, Nussi is very much involved in the progression of, you know, Irish players and Irish rugby. And my point being, there are many guys who would get an offer, say, to a Leinster or to a Munster, and it would have to go through the IRFU. Is this going to benefit Irish rugby in the long term? And, you know, there might be some ruffled feathers at a provincial level. There might be some, you know, a few people grumpy here and there, but ultimately the primary goal is Irish rugby. And I think it's a masterstroke that we've got him back, because he said many a time, you know, you don't go back twice or you don't do it again, you know, and we somehow managed to get him on a consultancy role. So I think it's very good from, I think, Phil Ward to make sure he's in the building. It's just got to make sure that we can utilize him as much as possible.
Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, that's about a wrap, I think. Matt, good to have you on the pod, and have a great week. A lot to digest. Super W we didn't really touch upon, but that's up and running as well. So there's a lot of rugby for you and your pleasing. Have a great week. Thank you.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for having us.